Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I want to start with Dak Prescott. It was not that long ago that people were debating whether or not Dak Prescott deserved to be paid like a superstar quarterback. We had that conversation and that discussion right here on the program. Now, two games in, he's got a passer rating of 142.9. He's got a completion percentage of 82.3%. He's got a 2-0 record. He has a Sports Illustrated cover. And that article in SI is all about one thing: money. Cash. It's all about how much money the Dallas Cowboys are making and how they negotiate with their players. And there's a really interesting subtext to the article. Subtext being a Dallas Cowboy means having perks, bennies, financial perks, meetings with movers and shakers, access to money and people who can make you even more money. As one agent told SI, quote, "The players know if you can put a team like this together and win Super Bowls, they'll have probably six-figure autograph deals for the rest of their lives. The Cowboys don't slam it down anyone's throat, but they let people know, if you stay here and good things happen, you're all going to be able to make money when you're done playing," end quote. All right, so that's really interesting in and of itself, because the subtext for Dak Prescott is even more clear. You might want to think about knocking a bit off your price, because being a Cowboy means you're going to make more money elsewhere. So do the right thing. Fact of the matter is, it's not even a subtext. It's not even a subtext because Stephen Jones comes right out and he says it. Quote, "We're trying to talk all of these guys into, hey, let's not take every last penny here. That's why the deals can't get done right away. We're trying to convince the Daks and Amaris and Zekes that, hey, we need to spread the money around. This is a distribution dilemma here," end quote. Man, that's some kind of phrase, isn't it? A distribution dilemma. Yeah, a distribution dilemma. Just so we're really clear, this is the same Stephen Jones who's also quoted in that same article as saying, quote, "Whether it's misplaced or not, I know this. We haven't won a Super Bowl in 23 years, which just kills me and it kills Jerry just as much. But you know, we're still the most valuable brand, most valuable team in sports. $5.5 billion. Number one, above all the soccer teams, the Yankees, and being involved with that is valuable since a lot of these guys talk about themselves in terms of their brand," end quote. Man, that's rich. It's one thing to think that. It's another to say that. And it's another to put it in our face. So just to recap, the Cowboys are worth more than $5.5 billion, more than any other sports franchise, but they have a distribution dilemma. Uh-huh. A distribution dilemma. Yeah, there's a dilemma, all right. The dilemma is, why are you asking guys to take less than market value while at the same time you're bragging about how much money you're worth? That's why the salary cap's a joke, because a team that claims to be worth $5.5 billion is claiming they don't have the money to pay market value for their players. They're worth $5.5 billion, more than any other franchise, and they can't wait to tell you. But they're telling their players, hey now, don't get greedy. Let's not take every last penny here. You see, if there really is a, quote, distribution dilemma when it comes to paying the Daks and Amaris and the Zekes, that's not a Dak problem, that's a Jones problem. Because they knew they were going to have to pay Amari when they made that deal for Amari. You see, Dak Prescott is not the lucky guy in this situation. The Cowboys are the ones who are lucky. He fell to them in the fourth round. That's how lucky they are. Jerry Jones, the QB guru that he is, wanted to take Johnny Manziel 2 years earlier. How would that have worked out? So, if you're worth $5.5 billion, why should Dak take a penny off his asking price? Yeah, and I know. The Jones family and you Cowboy honks would say Dak should take less money because that means he can stay as a Cowboy. And being the Cowboy quarterback means endorsements and fame. That being the quarterback of the Cowboys is a privilege. To which I say, psst, please.
Psst, please.
Listen to me carefully. Do you really think that Jerry or Stephen Jones tell potential sponsors or advertisers, hey, listen, we're going to give you a reduced rate because we're worth $5.5 billion and making plenty of money in other spots. We'll make that money up elsewhere so you can have a reduced rate. Hell no. They know the Cowboys are a premium brand, and anybody who wants to be associated with that premium brand is going to pay premium money. So the same thing should go for Dak. Being the Dallas Cowboys quarterback has value, but being the Dallas Cowboys Pro Bowl quarterback who has led them to the playoffs more times than they had been the previous 6 years has even more value. Value to the team. Value to the Jones. Nobody was talking about the value of being a Cowboys quarterback when those Cowboys quarterbacks were Chad Hutchinson and Quincy Carter. There wasn't a whole hell of a lot of buzz to being a Cowboys quarterback when John Kitna was roaming the sideline, or 41-year-old Vinny Testaverde was slinging it. The so-called perks of being a Cowboy? Yeah, that rap might work for a backup who's trying to pick between two teams and knows that playing in Dallas might mean a little extra on the side. But for a franchise quarterback, and Jarrah would say that Dak is that. But for a franchise quarterback, man, get out of here with that nonsense. I've said this time and time again. I'm going to say it again right now. Quarterback contracts are not about stats. They're about timing. If you're a franchise quarterback and your contract is up, you're going to get paid. And you're probably going to get the biggest contract around. And by the way, have you seen what's happening to quarterbacks so far this season? Any play could be your last play. Not only should Dak Prescott not give them a discount after the last two games, his price ought to be going up. Because you sure as hell know that if he stunk up that joint in those two games, everybody would be saying his price should go down. If the Cowboys want to claim that being a Cowboy is a privilege, they better recognize that having a good quarterback is a privilege, and they better pay for it. Dak Prescott right now is not lucky he's the Cowboys quarterback. The Cowboys are lucky that Prescott is their quarterback. So no, he should not take less pennies to make that thing work for everybody else. Especially when, at the same time, you're telling all of us, yeah, you know, we are richer than everybody else.
The pie is getting smaller.
And Tony Gonzalez, A Football Life, premieres tomorrow at 10 p.m. Eastern on NFL Network. So we've got a few things to get caught up on. Tony, good to have you back on the show. Tony, how are you?
I'm doing well, Jim. How you been, buddy?
Good, good, Tony. Great to get caught up. Good to have you back. Listen, it's been about a month, Tony, since you were inducted into the Hall of Fame. When you look back on that weekend, Tony, what are some of the moments that stick out to you the most?
Well, I think probably a lot of people talk about the luncheon that they have, the Ray Nitschke, Deacon Jones luncheon, where all the players get into a room and they just shut it. Nobody's allowed in the room. No coaches, no media, no anybody. And they just talk and they just hang out. That was really cool because, you know, growing up, you see, you have your fans, like Jim Brown is in that room, Dan Marino, you know, all these Hall of Fame greats from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and you're hanging out with them, you're in there, and they all got their yellow jackets on. That's when it became like, this is real. Like, I really made the Hall of Fame, one of the highlights. And then, of course, having my family there, especially my children, letting them see what I was able to do throughout my career, because, you know, they probably don't remember most of it, you know, besides my oldest son, Nico. And so I was really thankful that my younger kids were able to kind of see their dad up there on that stage getting recognized as you know, one of the best ever. It was a really special weekend for us.
That is tremendous. Tony Gonzalez joining us. Tony Gonzalez, A Football Life premieres tomorrow at 10 p.m. Eastern on NFL Network. Tony, during your speech, you went all the way back to your Pop Warner days and playing high school football at Huntington Beach High. What did coaches at Huntington Beach, people like Coach Pasco and Coach Curtis, mean to you both as a player and a person?
It was great. You know, obviously I had those guys out at the Hall of Fame with me. They're the ones who got me started. Everybody has to get a start somewhere. And Coach Curtis, he was my freshman football coach. I wanted to be a running back, Jim. And I thought I was going to be the next Bo Jackson or Marcus Allen, you know, being from L.A. here. And he was like, no, son, you're going to play tight end. So I've been playing tight end since my freshman year of high school football. I wasn't one of these, you know, guys that converted after college or something because I'm a basketball player. And then Coach Pasco, you know, allowed me to be my best version of myself back in high school. And it goes off the field where, you know, the mentorship from those guys. It was my basketball coach, too. Roy Miller was there. He was a big part of my development as a youth in high school. So it was just fun to give back to those guys, have them out at the Hall of Fame with me.
Sign up and become an O Rewards member today and earn 1 point for every $1 spent. Receive your rewards twice as fast and on the go when you provide your email address. O Rewards members get $5 back for every $150 you spend. It's fast, it's easy, and it's free only at O'Reilly Auto Parts. See store or orewards.com for details. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better parts, better prices every day. We're talking to Tony Gonzalez. Now, Tony, you made time to thank so many coaches, but one of them I really want to ask you about. You've played for a lot of great coaches, both in basketball and in football. Have you ever played for anybody else who is quite like Dick Vermeil?
No. Dick is amazing. I think what separates him as a coach, what he does differently, is he really does care about his players. And, you know, him and Carol, his wife, they would have a dinner once a week, and they'd host different positions on the team, and they'd have them over at their house. It doesn't matter if you're a practice squad guy, if you'd only been there a week, you're going to come over and you're going to have dinner with him and his wife, and he'll share some, you know, he loves wine, and he share his affection for wine and pour you some really good glasses of wine. And, it, you know, the closer you got to him, the better the wine was. So it was always fun to go over there. And then the emotion, too. Like, you know, he cried a lot. There's no secret to that, because he gets emotional. He really does care about us as players, as well as going out there and winning football games. That's why he's one of the best coaches ever, in my opinion.
We're talking to Tony Gonzalez. Tony Gonzalez, A Football Life does premiere tomorrow at 10 p.m. Eastern on NFL Network. Tony, I thought your speech was really, really interesting for a number of different reasons. You know, there was a word that you used quite a bit in the speech that people might be surprised by, and that was the word fear. What were you like as a Pop Warner player?
I was a fearful little kid, little child back then, and you know, I had the ability, obviously, but I didn't have it in my heart. I didn't have it in my mind because I was so scared of getting hit. I was so scared of standing out for whatever reason. And football did not work out for me young. My first year, I actually quit. And second year, I stayed on the team the whole year because my mom made me this time. But it really never clicked. It took me a couple years to finally come out of that. And that's where the bully came in because I was just afraid of everything. And then finally, you know, my whole bully story, I won't go into it here unless you want me to.
Yeah, no, go ahead, Tony. Tony, I think, well, if you don't mind, because I think that's, I mean, you're a Hall of Famer who dealt with something that most people deal with at some point. So if you don't mind, maybe you can get into it.
Well, then real quickly, you know, so I had this bully come after I played Pop Warner football those 2 years. My eighth grade year, I didn't play. But I had this bully that used to come down from the local high school, and I was in junior high, and he wanted to fight me, wanted to beat me up. So I hid from this kid every single day. And ran from him because I was scared. And then finally he called me up on the phone and said, I want to fight you. And I said, okay, give me a couple of weeks to train. and we set the date for the fight. I was going to the fight by myself. I had no friends at this point. Everybody thought I was a wimp. And I'm by myself heading to the fight. And there must have been, you know, every school in our neighborhood and high school must have known about the fight because they were there at the park. And so I did what any normal kid would do. I turned around and ran and went home, and things got worse after that. And it culminated at graduation at junior high. He shows up to the graduation, and I see him there, and I get scared. After the graduation's over, everybody throws their hat up. I go and hide behind a wall, and my family comes walking up looking for me, and they all find me at the same time. And that's when I saw the look on my mom's face and saw the look on my brother's face of complete disappointment, and because they knew what was going on. And they had told me, just get it over with, fight this guy. Just, who cares if you lose? You take an ass whooping, you take an ass whooping. But I was so scared. And I said to myself, I will never see that look on their face again. And it changed everything for me in that one instant. And I've never ran since then from anything that I'm afraid of. It doesn't mean I'm going to accomplish it right away. And that changed everything for me because football, the next year I went to high school, and all those same kids that I played Pop Warner with, they were on that team in high school. And they're looking at me like, oh, here he goes again, trying out again. But things were different this time. I wasn't afraid anymore, and I was able to go out there and put everything I had into it and go through that fear. It doesn't mean I wasn't afraid. I went through that fear now. I didn't let it paralyze me. and I kind of changed my life. It changed the trajectory of where I was going. So I'm kind of thankful for that bully. And that's kind of what the football life is about. It's about being thankful for those low times in your life.
Tony Gonzalez joining us on the program. I'm so glad you shared that story, Tony. Really quickly, did you ever run into the bully ever again? Did that ever reconcile, or was there any closure there?
Yeah, I saw him my junior year, and I was over at his high school now. He's a senior, and I kicked his ass, Jim. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
I love the way that story ended. Are you kidding?
I know. That's the way the Hollywood ending is. No, but I did see him, and I just saw him. And this time, now I'm like a monster. I'm 6'5", 210 pounds at this point. And I just looked at him and shook my head and didn't do anything to him. There's no reason to. Honestly, it was a gift that he gave me. It was the gift the hard way. And that's kind of a lesson for a lot of people. When you're going through those hard times, a lot of times that's where the biggest growth is. That's kind of what you need. That's life saying, hey, you got to work on this, and here's a gift for you, even though you don't want it. But take it and learn from it, and you'll be you'll be even a better version of yourself, and that's how it worked out for me.
That's so good. Tony Gonzalez joining us. Tony, you've had an amazing football life. That's a part of it right there, a big part of it. But you've had an amazing football life. So what was it like to be a part of this project, and then what kind of feelings do you think you'll have tomorrow night when it airs?
I think it's going to be great because everybody gets to see my story, and kind of like my podcast, it's wide open. I didn't hold back on anything. You're going to see the good, the bad, and the ugly of my career on how it all started. You know, when I was out there in Kansas City, the ups and downs of being there, the ups and downs of being with the Atlanta Falcons. And that's what I kind of, you know, mind, body, and spirit. That's kind of what I'm all about. You know, after my second year in the league, dropping all those balls, leading the league and drop passes, my life changed dramatically. I started reading books. I started learning about the process of success, mind, body, and spirit-wise, and it made me a better person in the long run. And you're going to see that story in the football life, see it up close and personal, told by me, and then not just me, but by my family, my friends, and my teammates. So I think people will get a lot out of it. Just watch. It's more than just watching me as a the big star tied in. It was much deeper than that.
It's Tony Gonzalez, Say Football Life. Once again, that does premiere tomorrow at 10 p.m. Eastern on NFL Network. Tony, I'm glad you mentioned your podcast. I wanted to ask you about that. It's called The Wide Open Podcast. It provides a look into what you're pointing out, you know, the way you embrace all the revolutionary changes taking place in the world of health, mindset, wellness, family. I know you've thought about these things for a long time, but how did that podcast first come to be, and how did you decide that health, mindset, wellness were the things that you want to focus on?
Well, that's what I'm all about. Like I said before, I mean, I'm obsessed with reading books like biographies. I want to read about Michael Jordan. I want to read about Tiger Woods, Kobe. I want to read about great politicians. I want to read about great musicians. Why them? Why are they? Is it something they're born with, or is it something that you can develop? And I really do believe it's something that you can develop. And then the spiritual side of it, how to calm your mind, how to be at peace, how to be present. All those things, and that's what the podcast is about. I bring guests on that have achieved great things, you know, true movers and shakers, you know, Michael Strahan, David Spade, Jessica Alba, Scooter Braun, and much, much more doctors that have been able to do these amazing things and then give us the secrets, give us the routines, the lessons that they've learned along the way, and then we can apply it in our life, because to me, that's what it's all about. I mean, that's probably, if you're into something, you should be into leveling up, being the best version of yourself, because you do that, then everything else you want in life will take care of itself. I've seen that in my life, and now I get to bring guests on and hopefully try to bring that out in their stories and share that with the world.
I love that line, Tony. Really quickly, one quick follow. Leveling up, what do you mean by that? You know, people talk about being squared away or leveling up. What's that mean to you?
To me, leveling up means playing the game of life with your heart. You know, any athlete out there who's ever played a sport, the inevitable phrase that you're going to get from your coach is going to be play with your heart and play with your heart. And what does that mean to me? You know, I always heard that, but I didn't really know what it meant. And to me, it means opening up your heart. If you're going to play with your heart, you got to get in your heart and you got to open it up. And that's what Tom Brady plays with. That's what Joe Montana played with. That's where, you know, the game slows down. It's peace. It's joy. It's no fear of judgment. You're in the moment, completely in the moment. And I was able to do that on the football field, but, you know, I've had a little trouble bringing that off the football field. And now that's the point of this podcast. Let's level up and be the best versions of ourselves, because there's, you know, success leaves clues, you know, copy genius, and then you make it your own version of that success. and you can, you know, you help your family, you help yourself, you help your family, you help your friends, you help society. So I get excited. Play with your heart. That's really what it is about for me.
Love it. He is a Hall of Famer. He's an NFL analyst. Tony Gonzalez, A Football Life, premieres tomorrow night, 10 p.m. Eastern on NFL Network. That's going to be tremendous. And also the host of the Wide Open Podcast. That is available right now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, and YouTube. Tony, that was great. So good to get caught up. I'll be looking for the show tomorrow night, Tony, and always good to talk to you.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Thanks for having me, bud.
Hey, Jim Rome here. When you want expert advice, you go to a pro. Now, some folks might consider me a pro at sports. Well, as a pro at sports, here is some simple advice that I can share with you. Example, when you're hitting up the sports book and a friend of yours tells you he's got a, quote, lock, you want my pro tip? Go the other way. Run the other way. There's a reason why those shiny casinos pop up out of the ground every other week in Vegas. There is no such thing as a lock in Vegas. So, when you're looking for pro tips on vehicle maintenance or repair, look no further than O'Reilly Auto Parts. Whether it comes to replacing your battery, getting advice on proper car maintenance, or even just getting the best bang for your buck, their expert team can help you out every step of the way. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better parts, better prices every day. Believe it or not, there was a time when Tennessee was one of the best teams in college football. There was a time when Tennessee was one of the best programs in college football. And I know that's hard to believe. Hard to believe when you consider they opened up the season with losses to Georgia State and BYU at home. Face it, when was the last time Tennessee got any legitimate national run? It was the kind of run that nobody wants. Run for Butch Jones and his turnover trash can. That's it. That's the last time anybody talked about Tennessee. And if you think that's hard to imagine, try this on for size. Remember when Lane Kiffin coached at Tennessee? Remember his one season there? That was an entire decade ago. Man, I hate playing that game. It only reminds me of how fast the clock is spinning and how we're all on the clock. That was 10 years ago. The Lane Kiffin, coach to Tennessee. The fact is, and the point of the take, Tennessee has not mattered since Kiff was there. They haven't. ESPN has a piece looking back on that season, and I've got to tell you, it was even better than I remembered. Like, I remember that year being amazing, but I do not remember it being this amazing. So why don't we start with the story of when Tennessee was going to take on top-ranked Alabama in Tuscaloosa. Tennessee fans remember that. College football fans might remember that. Tennessee getting ready to go to Tuscaloosa to take on top-ranked Alabama. The night before the game, the Vols had a meeting at their hotel. I'm just going to read this next line straight from the ESPN piece. Quote, Ed Orgeron wanted everybody's attention to get the Vols pumped up. The fiery defensive line coach took an overhead projector and hurled it into a wall where it shattered into pieces. End quote. Hell yes. Edward James Orgeron Jr., if you need him. That's how you get everybody's attention. You lob an overhead projector against the wall. So much better than Blake coming into the sales office in Glengarry Glen Ross. Do I have your attention? Do I have your attention now? That's what I thought. But Coach O, that was just the opening act. The big show was about to come. And that was a speech from Lane Kiffin that a former player said went like this. The former player said, quote, he gets up there and he says, I've already called back to the University of Tennessee and told them we're going to stay an extra night after we beat Alabama tomorrow. And we're going to go eat some of those Dreamland ribs and hang out at their bars, end quote. And it gets even better because according to that story, the entire place went crazy. It went wild. How wild? D. Lyman Wes Brown said, quote, I believe Monty even picked up a chair and threw it. Whatever we could get our hands on, we were throwing. It was total chaos. He's talking about 69-year-old Monty Kiffin, father of Lane and chucker of chairs. This is incredible. Coach O smashing an overhead projector. 69-year-old Monty throwing chairs and players saying, quote, whatever we could get our hands on, we were throwing. And that was all just a continuation of what started when Lane said at his introductory presser that everybody would be, quote, singing Rocky Top all night long after we beat Florida next year. It's going to be a blast, so get ready, end quote. I mean, there's so many things. How about that time? There was that time where he took that run at Urban Meyer after getting Nukeese Richard, a recruit that Meyer had wanted. When asked about that, Lane said, quote, I love the fact that Urban had to cheat and still didn't get Richardson, end quote. Who cares that Herb apparently didn't cheat in the recruitment of Richardson? That didn't matter. None of it did. Because it was the epitome and the definition of smoke weed, talk bleep, like Lane Kiffin. I'll get back to that connection. The Lane Kiffin, Lil Wayne connection in a second. Because in the meantime, Lane was talking bleep. And it was getting attention. Chris Walker, another player, said, quote, I remember thinking, either this dude can coach ball or we're going to get our heads beat in. But that was the beauty of playing for Lane. He had a swag about him that was real and didn't mind stepping on toes. End quote. My man wasn't just stepping on toes. He was stomping on toes. And it was awesome. Well, not for everybody. Because at one point, Tennessee booster Jimmy Haslam, that same Jimmy Haslam, he took Monty Kiffin aside, and according to Monty, he said, quote, listen, I like Lane a lot, I really do, and I think he's going to do big things here, but could you get him to zip it up a little bit, end quote. I'm not sure what Pop said, but what Monty should have said was, hey, zillionaire, I'm sure there's a building or four named after you here. You're probably the guy who signs both me and my son's checks. But no, I can't tell the kid to zip it up a little bit. Number one, it wouldn't do any good. Smoke weed, talk bleep like my kid, Lane Kiffin. And number two, this guy and his mouth are the best thing to ever happen to Tennessee. Best thing to happen to Tennessee football in a long time. So if you'll excuse me, super rich booster, I've got to throw some more chairs. Got to bounce. Lane, meanwhile, wants to make sure we all know that there was a method to his madness and a purpose behind everything. Lane said, quote, a lot of the things I was saying, that's straight out of Steve Spurrier 101. And people love Coach Spurrier taking a shot at somebody else and making a joke. That's who I grew up idolizing, Steve Spurrier. That's why I wear a visor and why I run a wide open offense. I grew up wanting to be Steve Spurrier. That's why it was so cool to beat him that season. End quote. All right, now there's some insight. I didn't know that. ESPN contacted Spurrier about that love from Kiff, and the head ball coach responded as only the HBC can, and I quote, oh no, don't blame it on me. I wasn't doing and saying some of the stuff he was. I know they clobbered us pretty good that year in that night game. How many years was he there? One or two? End quote. When he was told just one, Spurrier said, quote, seem longer. I guess a lot happened in that 1 year, end quote. See, here's the thing. After the projector smashing and the chair tossing, the Vols damn near did beat Alabama. They lost on a blocked field goal as time expired. They nearly beat them. But that didn't change Kiff as he went to shake Nick Saban's hand after the game. Lane Kiffin said to Nick Saban, quote, hey, good game. But that's the last time it's going to happen, end quote. A decade later, Kiffin shrugs, quote, it was the last time it happened. It's the last time he beat me, so I guess that part of it's true. Like a dumbass, I also didn't know I was going to need a job from him in 5 years either, end quote. I mean, I've done almost a whole take on this for a whole segment, and there is so much more. There's too much from that 1 year to keep recapping. But then it all ended when USC called and offered him their head coaching job, which did not go well in Knoxville, as you might recall. Quoting from the article, with students and fans burning mattresses, and shouting obscenities directed at Kiffin while he barricaded himself in his office at the complex before he could finally be escorted by police to his home in Knoxville sometime around 4 a.m., end quote. I mean, do you ever remember hearing or seeing anything like that ever before? So what started as talking junk and smashing projectors ended with burning beds and shouted obscenities. So as great as that time was, it's even better to look back. So let me say this right here and right now. As wild and insane as that was, Tennessee has never been as good or as interesting or as buzzy since. And I'm not looking to get anybody fired. But when that job does open up again, that school better make one call and one call only. Again, I know they have a coach. I'm not looking to get anybody fired. But when that job opens up, it is time to forgive and forget. It is time to bring him back. It is time to bring back Lane. Bring back the smashed projectors. Bring back the surprised black jerseys. Bring back Monty throwing chairs. Bring it all back. It's okay now. Lane is more reflective. Lane is a better coach. Lane's a better guy. And Tennessee needs him now more than they ever have. Let's do this. Every AD that I know, every athletic director, he's got a short list of coaches that he or she would consider hiring in the event that their coach leaves or their coach gets fired. I'm sure Phil Fulmer has his list. That list better have one name on it, and only one name. Lane Monty Kiffin. Smoke weed, talk like Lane Kiffin. Bring him back. Martin Truex Jr. is my guest. Martin, nice to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing great, Jim. How are you?
Good, good. So let me start right here. You're coming off that win in the playoff opener in Vegas. And as you said, you took a gamble. You qualified 24th. And quote, for a while, it wasn't looking too smart with the four out front. Got the right adjustments in the end. Had a great car all day long. End quote. So how significant were the adjustments and how much did that change things?
Well, it was very significant. And, you know, I felt like without the right adjustments at the end, we probably would have run second. So overall, just a great day, an awesome way to kick off the playoff. You know, you always want to start the postseason there with some momentum, and winning that first one is huge. So proud of the team. Everybody did a great job, and, you know, the next 2 weeks for us, we're through the next round. So it's really all about trying to get as many bonus points as possible because, you know, they're crucial to try to get to Homestead. So hopefully the next 2 weeks we'll get some bonus points and then go into the round of 12 and keep that momentum going.
Right, so one more thought about the end of that race in addition to what you just said. From the outside, it seems like you had a really good final pit and everything was clicking. So how much pride is there in executing like that when it matters most?
Well, that's just it. It's key. I mean, you know, when the pressure's on, when the playoffs start, everybody feels it, right? I mean, the intensity ramps up. You know every single decision you make, every time you come down pit road, everything you do is critical. And, you know, for our guys on pit road to have an awesome pit stop that last time around, it was big for them, big for confidence, you know. And, you know, they know now that when the pressure's on, they can deliver. And that's a big deal because, you know, with the elimination style racing, you know, you have one bad pit stop towards the end of the race or something happens, it could take you out of a, you know, potential run at the championship. So huge deal all the way around for the whole team, you know, from the top to bottom. And it felt really good to go back to victory lane as well.
Martin Truex Jr. is my guest. So the win on Sunday was your fifth of the season. And I would say for pretty much anybody else in the sport, that'd be a great, great year. But it was your first win since June and your first on an oval since Charlotte. It's not a long time to go without a win. But when you have the expectations that you have and the team has, did it feel like a long time?
Yeah, it kind of did. You know, I felt like we, you know, we'd been in position to maybe win a few since then. And just seems like for whatever reason, little things were going wrong. We were making little mistakes here and there. It's just, you know, races weren't playing out the way we needed them to. And I felt like we were, you know, we were just not getting much luck to roll our way. So, you know, going into the playoffs, I was a little worried about that. I was like, all right, you know, we've been right there, but how do we fix the little things? Can we do all the little things right? And so to, you know, for it all to come together, it felt great. And, winning's always fun. Obviously we want to win every week, but it's difficult in this sport. And 5 wins this year so far has been really good. And just to kick off the playoffs with that shot in the arm is big for the whole team. And it doesn't guarantee us anything going forward, but it gives us that confidence to know we're doing the right things. And for the last 6 or 7 races, it had been, well, we felt like we were doing the right things, but they weren't working out the way we needed them to. So it's kind of funny how racing works. Sometimes things just don't go your way, and sometimes they do. And we were able to capitalize, so it felt good.
Martin Truex Jr. is joining us. All right, so you start the playoffs off with that win, which means you've already clinched a spot in the next round. How much does getting that win impact the way you approach this week at Richmond? I mean, does it take some of the pressure off, or does it make you go even harder?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think for us, it somewhat takes the pressure off, but at the same time, there's so many points available, so many bonus points especially. And, you don't want to change. We don't want to change who we are. We don't want to change how we approach things, because in 2 weeks, things reset, and we've got to be, we've got to be able to get the job done at a high level again. So I think we don't really change anything. I feel like we go into Richmond to try to win. Any time we can get those bonus points is going to be huge. So just go in there and do the same things we've been doing the last few weeks, and hopefully things roll our way like they did in Vegas.
So is it different when you're running the playoffs? I mean, as an example, as a driver, does it feel different, or is racing just racing no matter where you do it and what's at stake?
I would say it's definitely different. I mean, I think that, again, every decision you make, everything that goes on is critical to a run at the championship. And the situation we're in, we're right there at the top now, and we want to stay there. We don't want to back off and say, oh, the next 2 weeks don't mean anything to us. They do. They're huge for momentum, bonus points on the line, and just to try to keep things going in the right direction. So we're pushing hard. I know the guys are excited about Richmond. We won there in the spring. And, this is another big weekend for us. I just feel like, when the playoffs start, everybody is so critical of themselves on every single little piece of this thing, because it's so difficult to make it to Miami at the end of the season. And we want to stay pushing, keep it on top, and hopefully stay up front.
We're talking to Martin Truex Jr. for a few more moments. Now, it's been about 10 months since it was announced that you would be joining Joe Gibbs Racing. What have the last 10 months been like for you?
It's really been good. I mean, I had a lot of confidence in the decision to go there just because of the relationship I had with them the past 2 seasons. When I was out in Colorado, Furniture Row, we had the Team Alliance. So we shared a lot of information, and, I got to know a lot of the people there and kind of understood what they expected of me. And I knew really, I felt like I knew what to expect out of the team. And at the same time, you go to a new team and it's like, okay, I feel good about it, but you never know how it's going to go. So I've been super excited about our season we've had, to go to a new team and have 5 wins and be sitting top of the playoff standings and after the first race is huge. So just excited about it. Coach Gibbs is amazing. He's an awesome team owner, and it's been a lot of fun to spend some time with him, see how he does things. Such a great leader, and I've definitely learned a lot from him throughout the season.
Additionally, you and I have talked in the past about your journey and growing up the son of Martin Truex Sr., but if you were to take me back to the days at Wall Stadium in New Jersey, what was it like to watch racing there and then to get out on the track there yourself?
I grew up going there as a kid, and I spent a lot of time in the stands and just always dreamed of, being able to drive there someday. And I'll tell you, Jim, I was already in my 19, 20, 21 in that area and having success driving race cars and winning races and things, but I never seen what my future was going to look like. I never thought I'd get to this level. So it's been a crazy, crazy ride, a lot of fun, and a lot of hard work, a lot of ups and downs throughout the years, but man, it's all been worth it. It's been awesome, and just hope we can keep it going.
Hey, before you go, Martin, to that point, I mean, when you look at where you are right now, you're having one of the all-time great careers. How much of the sport, though, is about the grassroots racing moments like the ones we're talking about now?
Well, I think that's what it's all about, really. I mean, if you think about our sport, everybody comes from a short track somewhere, their local track, and without those short tracks and without those, fans going and supporting their local tracks and kids like me growing up, you know, watching local heroes and saying, man, someday I want to race out there with those guys. Someday I want to get on that racetrack. So really without that, there's no way for us to ever get to the, you know, to the Cup Series and the Xfinity Series and things like that. So it was huge for me. I know that everybody in our sport came from somewhere like that, and it's definitely a critical part of racing.
Yeah, but Martin, not everybody came from working on the family's clam boats like you did. What was that job like?
It was hard. It was a tough job, but it taught me a lot, and you know, a lot about work ethic and the things you can do if you're willing to work for it. So I was definitely lucky to be able to have that in the family and you know, have something to do to go make enough money to go racing. And you know, it's something I would never change. It taught me a ton. It taught me that, you know, if I'm willing to work hard, I can do anything I want. And you know, that's really what it's all about. So they're still going. The family business is still going, and you know, a lot of the family still works there. But you know, for me, I'm glad I don't have to do that anymore, and I was able to work my way up from there.
So imagine this crazy scenario. You're walking down the street, minding your own business. Bam! There's a $100 bill right there in the street. What would you do? Would you pick it up? Or would you walk right over it and just keep moving? Of course you'd take the money. So that said, why do you keep picking winners without betting on them? This is why I go to my bookie. Because it's fast, it's easy, and if I pick a winner, man, I want to get paid. Let's face it. Where you're betting is just as important as who you're betting on. I would not be telling you all to bet with them if they were not the best. Do the smart thing. If you're going to bet football this season, then bet with MyBookie. Did you know that you could bet on games after kickoff? For instance, if by the second half it looks like your bet is going to lose, you can always go the other way. I've done that. I've had success doing that. If you're the kind of guy that likes to bet a little but win a lot, try a parlay. If all your picks do come through, you multiply your winnings. And no matter how you bet, the NFL season is the best time of year. So join right now. Do it now, and MyBookie will double your first deposit. That is a great deal. Use the promo code Rome. Activate that offer. Promo code Rome. Visit MyBookie.ag today. You play, you win, you get paid. And today, my responsibility includes informing the masses that the power drunk colonel at Kentucky Fried Chicken has officially pressed the little red button beneath his desk. Many of you are aware that right now we are a country at war. A country at war right now. The so-called fried chicken sandwich war of the summer of 2019. That war. It's a war that Chick-fil-A dominated, uncontested, for years. But then Popeyes rolled out their own fried chicken sando. That happened last month. That started a real-life battle of Winterfell. Memes were exchanged on Twitter. Lines wrapped around fast food buildings. Sold-out signs broke the hearts of gluttons nationwide. And eventually, Popeyes kamikazed itself with its own success and ran out of ammo. Literally ran out of ammo. So right now, you cannot buy a fried chicken sando from Popeyes because the gluttons ate all of them. Think about that for a second. There's none left. Popeyes pulled a Tesla. They introduced a product so wildly popular and sought after that they could not meet the demand. So now Chick-fil-A is back on top, without rival. Or so they thought. Because here comes KFC rushing into the brawl. And KFC is not going to bring a chicken sando to a chicken sando fight. Nope. They're bringing a weapon of mass sugary fried destruction to a chicken sandwich fight. Business Insider has this harrowing report that KFC is currently testing a fried chicken and donut sando at 40 stores in Virginia and Pennsylvania. You heard me correctly. A fried chicken and donut sandwich. If you're having trouble picturing it, imagine a giant breaded chicken breast sitting arrogantly between two big, fat, glazed donuts. Ladies and gentlemen, the nuke has been fired. It's one thing to eat fried chicken in a bun. It's one thing to maybe sub out that bun. Maybe you want to be actually a little more healthy about it. Maybe you want to replace that bun with a lettuce wrap. That's widely accepted. That's a way to cut down on carbs. Replacing a bun with two Krispy Kremes is a widely accepted way to induce a diabetic coma.
Krispy Kreme, fat boy!
I mean, this is perverse. This is disgusting. This is revolting. This is sickening. This is wrong. This is so far beyond unnecessary. And you're taking your life into your own hands if you have the audacity to order one of these things. This is not the county fair with the kind of gamble on a heart attack where that's part of the experience, where you know that when you go to the county fair. It's freaking KFC. And now they're going to sell, allegedly, heroin sandwiched between crack for $7.99. And guess what your fried chicken and donut sandwich comes with? Potato wedges and a soda. Yeah, because they were going to serve that with cantaloupe and broccoli. Hell no, they weren't. It's perfect, right? If you're going to die, you may as well die at a KFC. Drenched in sugar, batter, chicken, starch, and cola. Ike's like, where are they doing this? When are they doing this? How much does this cost? Where is this? Is this in Cali? Can you imagine washing down a fried chicken and donut sando with Pepsi or Mountain Dew? Chasing it with a wedge or five? How long till KFC gets rid of the soda machines and replaces them with a chocolate fountain? How long before they kick the wedges to the curb and go with straight sticks of butter? These are fair questions, because they literally just replace bread with glazed donuts. Do you have to sign a waiver before you eat this thing? How about filling out a will? Do you have to FaceTime your kids to let them know how much you love them? KFC clearly is going through an identity crisis right about now. I mean, earlier this summer, weren't they testing vegan nuggets? Then they saw Popeyes, teabagging Chick-fil-A, and then their entire plan flipped? Hey, you know those healthier nuggets, those vegan nuggets, those plant-based nugs we're working on? Scratch that. To hell with that. Get me the biggest piece of fried chicken you can find and jam it between two donuts and then sell it with fries and a soda for $7.99. Do it. Do it now. If you're going to do it right. I wouldn't even do it with glazed donuts. I'd get like two of those gigantic apple fritters. You know those donuts? The ones that are probably like 4,000 calories each? I'd get two of the biggest apple fritters. You know, maybe an apple fritter on one side and a bear claw on the other. Man, let's go all in. If you're going to go fried chicken sando, don't be doing it with donut holes or glazed donuts. Go big-ass apple fritters. Then again, I shouldn't be surprised though, right? It's the same company who once used chicken breasts for a bun and a bacon and cheese bit for a filling.
Two pieces of cheese,
two pieces of bacon,
and two pieces of chicken.
So long, bun.
Mm-hmm.
Now this is a chicken sandwich.
The new KFC Double Down Chicken
I'm
Sandwich.
Not even, so much 100%. I'm not even here to crack on either one of those things. Like, I like donuts. I like fried chicken. I don't need them together. Like, I like bacon and I like donuts, but I'm not all about that bacon on donuts. You know, I like sugar, I like salt. I don't like them both at the same time. And I pride myself on never telling anybody what to do with their body. But clones, ladies, gentlemen, beaks, don't do this. Not unless a doctor has given you exactly one day to live. They're still in the testing phase. The nationwide rollout has not happened. It does not need to. No one needs to put two donuts and a piece of fried chicken in their face for lunch. That's a last meal in prison. That is not a second meal in the middle of a workday. That is not your breakfast, lunch, and dinner writ. If you're thinking about eating this sando, don't. Probably better served just ripping cigs inside a tanning bed instead. It'll be healthier. Or listen to Jocko. Jocko's made it pretty clear. If your will is not stronger than a will of a donut, then you ain't going to make it.
Donuts to me just represent the absolute epitome and pinnacle of things that you should stay away from. Because let's face it, donuts have absolutely zero nutritional value whatsoever. They are purely made to taste good and give you nothing but make you fat and unhealthy. So when I see a donut, I just get angry that there's a donut. And what I find funny is, you know, I work with businesses all over the country, and what's funny is, for some reason, donuts make people feel so immediately gratified that people just bring donuts into the office and give them away to everyone for free. And yeah, I'm not a big fan of donuts. Donuts are sugar-coated lies. That's all they are. And they're lying to you with their beautiful taste and their jelly-filled center. So don't believe the lies and stay away from donuts. Your life will be better, I promise.
Jocko Willink. That epic rant on donuts. Dear Jim, donuts. It's about time they came up with the chicken donut sandwich. Now we're talking regards fat Americans. Fat. Me and Hartford. Dear Jim, I don't care if I gotta die. Cream, jelly, or fried chicken, better have my donuts.
Train, planes, and automobiles. Better have my donuts.
Sincerely, Delonte. Terry Francona is my guest. Terry, it's great to have you back. How are you?
Damn, Jim, can you say that again? That's kind of felt good.
My man, I could say that all day long. Terry, you know that? You know that? I got
it's
such
good to talk to you. How are you?
I'm great, Terry. Such respect and admiration for you. It's great to have you back. Listen, you beat Detroit last night 2-1 on a Yasiel Puig walk-off single with two outs in the 10th. As a manager, Terry, you have seen every kind of pressure situation in September. So what kind of emotions were you feeling last night in the 10th? And then how did you feel when Puig came through with that knock?
Man, it's the hardest thing to explain. It's like your stomach's up in your throat. And, you know, you feel like we're going to find a way to win. But you're not sure how. And then it's part agony. But saying that, I wouldn't change it for the world. Like, I mean, it's like, it's why you do this job. I mean, to live through those moments. And some of the time, you know, you come out on the short end of the stick. And it's like you're ripping your heart out. But when you do it with guys that you care about, it just brings you closer. And, you know, fortunately last night we were one better. It wasn't easy, but we were one better. And after the game, music's blaring, and that's what matters.
Terry Francona joining us. You know, Puig, Terry, has been with you since the trade deadline. A few weeks back, he called you, quote, the best manager I have ever been around, end quote. Now, you've been around every kind of player, every kind of personality. What's it been like to manage Puig so far?
You know what? You always try to do your homework. I think we have an obligation to do that. And there's guys that I trust in this game that Yasiel has played for before. So I, you know, did my homework. At the same time, I think you have an obligation to the player that they come in with a clean slate, because I don't think that's fair to them if you're waiting for somebody to make a mistake. Like, we had an incident in Minnesota where he didn't run. And, you know, he, right when it was over, Santana went up to him right away, which I thought was great. And then he came to me and he goes, I am so sorry. Well, for the next 4 days, he said, Tito, I am so sorry. I said, Yasi, it's over. You know, let's not do it again. And that's what I care about is guys are going to make mistakes, but let's not repeat them. And he means well. Like, I don't know, he's actually been kind of enjoyable. I mean, he listens to everything. And he's his own person now, don't get me wrong. And there's been a couple throws that I wish we could take back. But he's fun to be around.
Terry Francona joining us. What a great response. Now, if we were to go back, Terry, to early June, the team was under 500 in more than 11 games out of first in the division. Corey Kluber has not pitched any games since May 1st. Carlos Carrasco was diagnosed with leukemia in June. And the list goes on and on. It would have been pretty easy, it seems to me, for guys to throw in the towel and say, it's just not meant to be. This is one of those transition years. But that hasn't happened. You guys are right there in the hunt. How do you explain that?
You know, the day that Kluber and Clevinger, when they both went down, and then, you know, this was before Carrasco, and we had a meeting, and I said, guys, I said, winning just got harder. I said, doesn't mean we can't do it, but our margin for error just got less. I said, but we can still win. You know, there's not going to be one single person that's going to feel sorry for us outside of this room. So we have two choices. We can either choose to find a way to win or feel sorry for ourselves and get beat. And I'll tell you what, the guys that have come up, and guys like Plesac, Savali, Plutko, I mean, Savali and Plesac, they had like three or four starts in AAA, and all of a sudden they're smack right in the middle of a playoff race, and they don't back down from anybody, which makes it really fun. And then I know your boy Bieber, he's kind of turned into an ace, like right in front of our eyes. Like I hear myself saying the same things about Bieber this year that I was about Kluber 7 years ago, which is, in my opinion, about the best compliment you can give somebody.
Oh, yeah, it is. You know, Terry, I was trying to stay in my shoes not to ask you about my guy. I was going to get there, but I'm so glad you brought that up. You know, as a UC Santa Barbara alum, there's no way I could get through the interview without talking about Shane Bieber. Top 10 in the American League in wins, innings, strikeouts, ERA, winning percentage, complete games. He was the MVP of the All-Star game, and he only made his Major League debut last May. How far has he come since then?
And top 10 in people. I mean, this kid's off the charts, man. He's what you're looking for. I mean, this kid, he just keeps getting better. You know, he reminds me a lot of Kluber. I mean, not satisfied. You know, so when he has a good game, his 4 days in between his starts are so rigid and work. You know, he gets his work done and he's got a great routine. But he's a really good kid, man. I mean, he's always quick to smile. But when he's on the mound, he's ready to. He shows up to kick your ass. That's what you're looking for.
Terry Francona is my guest. I got to ask you one quick follow, and you answer this in part, but I had his college coach, Andrew Checkitz, on this show the day after the All-Star game, and we talked about the fact that Bieber was a walk-on initially who was on the verge of maybe not even making the team. So from a baseball standpoint and development standpoint, how do you explain a guy like him being in that spot only a few years back, and now he is a vital piece for a team in the postseason hunt?
Well, I'll tell you what. Okay, we have a fall development program where we bring in about 15 players, and that's actually happening this weekend. And one of the things I kind of wanted to talk to him about was, it doesn't matter where you got drafted. Look at Bieber. Look at Savali. Look at Plesac. I mean, these are guys. Some of these guys were sitting in their room last year at the same time. They're helping us try to win a pennant this year. I'm proud of our organization. I think our pitching guys have done an unbelievable job, but I think it comes down to the person, and these guys have just, like, the game gets going so much faster at each level, and when I look up, it doesn't look like it's going too fast for them. Yeah, they might give up a home run, or they might not make a great pitch all the time, but it's not because of the speed of the game or where they're pitching. It's just that, I mean, they're kind of inexperienced. I think to expect them to be perfect isn't fair.
Terry Francona joining us 100%. Terry, going back to Carrasco for a minute, he rejoined the team at the beginning of September and he's been working out of the bullpen. What was it like to go through the process with Cookie, and how emotional was that moment when he returned to the mound on September 1st?
You know what? It was, we were down in Tampa and we were actually getting beat around. And both teams, and I give Tampa a lot of credit. I mean, Kevin Cash, is everybody knows how close I am with him. So it's not a surprise that they would show that kind of class. But everybody stood on the field when he was warming up. And I'm sure it was hard for Cookie to kind of, you know, go from that to trying to get people out. And that's what I kind of explained to him, like, after about his second outing. I'm like, okay, we got to get in compete mode now, because he was in rehab mode for so long that now, hey, we got to get hitters out. And that's what we're trying to do, is get him on a roll, you know, now, so he can be a huge weapon for us. So we've been trying to pitch him enough without pitching him too much, and because we know what he can do when he gets hot.
You do know that, you know, and then you look a few weeks back, you made the point that there's nothing worse than coming to the ballpark every night, Terry, in August when you're 20 games out, despite all these challenges. And I didn't mention half the challenges, but despite all these challenges, you guys are right there in the middle of this. You're playing meaningful games in September. I could tell when you and I started the interview and I talked about last night's walk-off that there's juice in this still. How energizing and exciting is it to be in that spot?
And you said it perfect right there. My biggest fear in the world is coming to the ballpark in August or September and not being in it. That is really hard to do. I've been through that before, and I don't want to do it again. Coming to the ballpark with, like, a mixture of nervousness, a little bit of anxiety, like, you know, hey, man, whatever we do, not just tonight, but every single play could mean so much. God, I think it's like what a drug would be. I don't know that for a fact, but, you know, I think you get my point.
Sure.
I mean, it's like, are you kidding me? Like, this is what we're here for, and it's fun. And yeah, sometimes you get your heart ripped out, but I mean, it's why we put all these hours in, so we can be in a place like this.
Listen, Terry, you're all in, you're focused, you're locked in, you got a job to do, I understand this, and I know when the Indians are playing good ball, that town is electric, but you know also that's an amazing football town. Before I let you go, are you paying attention to the Browns? Have you spent any time around the facility? What are your impressions of the new-look Browns?
You know what, it's hard to not, because, like, kind of like the Cavs, like, I can't sit here and say I was a devout Cavs fan. I mean, I grew up in outside of Pittsburgh, but it was hard not to be interested in the Cavs because of LeBron and everything he brought. You know, it was like it was, you know, it was important. And it's kind of that way with the Browns now. Like, you watch Mayfield and what he brings. He's got a presence about him, and you see the receivers they brought in. And, you know, obviously I get tunnel vision a little bit on what we're doing, but I'd never root against a team in our town. I mean, when the Cavs had that parade, I went up to the top level of our stadium and watched it, because it went right around the stadium, and I got goosebumps, not only the way the fans reacted, but the way the Cavs reacted to the fans. I thought it was incredible. And it was fun to watch.
It's a Cleveland thing. It's a great, great town. It's a great sports town. The fans there are so hungry. They want it so badly. And the Indians are right there. They're half game out in the wild card, four games out of first in the division. And that is one of my favorite moments every year during the season. Terry Francona is their manager. Terry, I appreciate you so much. Great to have you back. Thank you.
Jim, I enjoyed it. You take care of yourself, okay?
You too. Skip.
See you, man.
Always.
Good night now.